You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the United Steelworkers Local 12561. And SMART, the Sheet Metal Workers, Local 2. USWA, that's Steelworkers Local 12561, bringing you quality service and safe natural gas from Local 12561, serving Kansas City, Kansas Gas Service and Missouri Gas Energy customers. And SMART, the Sheet Metal Workers Local 2, represents 1,200 members in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. We start with the sheet metal and make nearly anything out of it for industry, heating, and air conditioning, architectural roofs and siding, kitchens, and even works of art. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, frequent guest Professor Chuck Ross joins the show again as the football season nears. Will the anthem policy hold? Will Trump's fight with black athletes boil over? Then, Kansas City, Missouri is giving more public money for the Three Light development. Like many cities across the country, it subsidizes rent for the rich, while rent for the poor continues to rise. How do we stop this? In the news, what are they saying about labor's victory over right to work? And Trump's plan for postal privatization coming soon to a mailbox near you. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel, and she'll talk about how Missourians made history on Tuesday. And now for the news.
News from our side, August 9th to 2018. In federal government buildings across the country, public employee unions are being kicked out of offices where they meet with workers they represent. It's the result of a set of executive orders issued by President Trump in May. Federal unions say the move is aimed at weakening them, and Democrats and Congress agree. NPR's Brian Naylor reported about what happened at Local 2809 of the American Federation of Government Employees. The eviction notice went out in early July. The local's president says the union was told to vacate its office at the end of the month. The union represents some 1,200 workers at the Social Security office in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Even the bulletin board had to come down. Barry Sue Bryant, the president, said workers are confused. Now they have to tell the supervisor if they want to talk to a union representative. When we had our office, they would just stop in on their breaks and lunches. So now management knows if they want to seek advice from the union office. Bryant said she can still meet with members in the cafeteria, but that's hardly private. The union has offered rent to the office from government, but has not heard back. She says it may be nearly impossible to represent workers. And it's not just Social Security Administration. Unions representing federal agencies across government are facing similar restrictions on their ability to represent workers who may have beefs with their boss or concerns about working conditions or hours. In some places, there was a written agreement with a government union to use office space, but the government is ripping them up.
Tuesday's repudiation of Proposition A, right to work, is being hailed by union supporters as both a tremendous victory and a turnaround for labor. The anti-union crowd ironically blames their loss on money, which of course they have oodles of, but for some reason chose not to spend it. It's true that labor outspent them by a lot, but labor also out-organized them too. The HuffPost interviewed Erin Schrempf of We Are Missouri. She said that by Election Day, more than 2,000 volunteers had worked for the campaign, many of them union members. They knocked on over 800,000 doors and made nearly a million phone calls urging people to vote no on the proposition. According to Schrempf, the outreach probably played a role in the higher-than-expected turnout for an August primary. One voter in St. Louis told Huffington Post that he was contacted about 8 times by the No campaign, either by telephone or mailer, in recent weeks. If there was a strong argument in favor of the right to work law, he never heard it. The yes side didn't contact him once. So lesson number one is something Missouri Jobs with Justice has been teaching for years. People plus money equals power. And this election massed enough power to beat the National Right to Work Committee, industrialist David Humphreys, the Missouri Chamber of Commerce, Americans for Prosperity, and the Koch brothers, and throw in a dollop of ex-Governor Eric Greitens' dark money. So what does it all mean? Let's hope the American prospect's Robert Kuttner is right when he wrote on August 8th, by trying to crush labor, Missouri Republicans signaled not individual rights, the usual pitch for the misnamed right to work law, but their contempt for working people who got the message. The Missouri outcome also bodes well for the re-election of Senator Claire McCaskill, one of the supposedly endangered Democrats up this fall. More importantly, it signals the resurgence of the labor movement and reminds Democrats that progressive economics are the indispensable ingredient for success on the beaten-down American heartland. Congratulations to Missouri and the thousands of activists and unions and others who pounded the pavement to crush right to work once again in this state, just like they did 40 years ago.
Tuesday's Washington Post ran an opinion piece by Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, about Trump's plan for postal privatization. Here's a bit of it. The U.S. Postal Service is the most popular government agency in the country with a favorability rating of nearly 90%. But now, President Trump is apparently bent on destroying it. This week, a task force created following an April executive order from Trump is scheduled to deliver its recommendations for an overhaul of the Postal Service. Led by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, the task force is expected to endorse the privatization proposal buried in the White House's plan to reorganize the federal government, a radical assault on the administrative state. That reorganization plan claimed that USPS's current model is unsustainable. But while the Postal Service is losing money, its financial woes are largely the result of bad policy. Nearly all of the agency's losses over the past decade are attributable to a 2006 law requiring it to pre-fund retiree health benefits for 75 years, an onerous mandate that doesn't apply to any other agency. As the Postal Service's Office of Inspector General explained in 2015, the pre-funding requirement essentially amounts to a credit card company saying, "You will charge $1 million on your credit card during your life. Please include $1 million in your next payment." To find out more about the postal privatization plan, tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. The news tonight was read by Aaron Blackman, Ariana Eckel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Welcome, everyone, to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Joining me today is Professor Charles Ross. He's been on the show a few times. He's the author of Mavericks, Money and Men, The AFL, Black Players, and the Evolution of Modern Football. And the Kansas City Chiefs are starting off their preseason tonight, so I thought it would be a good time to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you again.
Great. There's, you know, just so many different stories that are going on right now that are really, things that you've been covering for a long time. So I did want to start talking about the anthem policy this year. We're pretty much at the end of free agency at this point. Eric Reed, the safety who has been a longtime supporter of Colin Kaepernick, is still not signed. I was just wondering your analysis about the anthem policy and how you think that it's influencing personnel decisions.
Well, you know, they don't have a concrete policy yet that they have. They're still working between the NFL and the Players Association to come up with something that they feel both sides can live with. There clearly is going to be, it appears, repercussions for those players that protest or kneel during the anthem. What that is, what the length of time or amount of money or however that is worked out, is going to be, I think, significant, because there are several players who have up to this point indicated that they plan to still protest. Mm-hmm. So if Malcolm Jenkins, the Philadelphia Eagles, the lineman for the Tennessee Titans, decide to take a knee or put their fist in the air, what exactly is going to be maybe the fine or the result of that? Or is it, you know, are they going to file a grievance with the Players Association against the policy? So there are a lot of ways in which this is going to go. Are players simply going to accept whatever the NFL Players Association comes up with and decide not to protest? Stay in the locker room and then come out when the anthem is over. There are a lot of ways this is going to go, so we're just going to have to kind of see. And we're probably not going to see anything maybe in the preseason. I would imagine that what's going to happen is this thing will continue to build, and once the bell rings to kick off the season, then we're going to find out what individual players decide they want to do.
And behind the scenes in all of this, of course, is the president, Donald Trump. And a lot of people say that he's sort of been intimidating the NFL owners, or, you know, that he sort of uses his base to scare them. But it looks like he doesn't intimidate everyone. I was wondering about your take on his latest beef with LeBron James, with King James, and bringing Michael Jordan into it. What did you think about all that? And do you think that you know, his fight with, he seems to just constantly be picking fights with black athletes.
Well, I mean, you said it. He continues to pick fights with African-American athletes, which, you know, again, I think President Trump is someone that has opened himself up to clear charges that he harbors some serious negative racial connotations, beliefs, as it relates to people of color. And when you put into context what took place in Charlottesville, Virginia, and his comments of arguing that both sides, that these neo-Nazis that facilitated violence that resulted in the loss of life of a young lady, were both at fault. When he, you know, was highly critical of black athletes last year and called them SOBs and that they needed to be kicked out of stadiums, and that these basically was almost a kind of message to these white males, the majority who own these NFL franchises, that you need to step up and be a man and put these guys back in their place. You're paying them, and make them be respectful. We've got a lot of fans out here that are paying good money. People are buying suites. There's TV. It's a bad look. It's our national anthem, and they are being paid by you as workers. And so they ought to be thankful. Otherwise, they, you know, might be in some inner city doing something dysfunctional, and so you guys are saving them. So, hey, they need to just step up and do the right thing and stand their toes on the line and put their hand over their heart, and that should be the end of it. And, of course, you know, his latest comments against LeBron James and Don Lemon, saying that Don Lemon is a dumb person and LeBron James is even less intelligent than Don Lemon. It is really racially divisive, and LeBron James put his finger right on it. I think that his comment needs to be expanded, that the president is simply not trying to divide the country using sports. He's dividing the country racially. because number one, I think that personally, you know, he has some issues with African Americans and minorities. He comes down extremely hard on those groups. And so I don't think there's any reason to waver in terms of why you would think that, you know, he harbors these kinds of racist beliefs. And, you know, he's not complimentary of this school that this professional athlete has opened. There's no comment about the fact that he has opened up a school for young kids to now attend for free to get an education. To me, as the President of the United States, that is the most important thing that you should be commenting on, that this young man could be spending his money on a lot of other different things, but yet he's trying to help empower young inner city kids. And to try to now divide him also and say that Michael Jordan is a smarter, more conservative, someone that, you know, hey, I really like, because Michael Jordan has not been the most aggressive individual in terms of sharing his opinion, you know, regarding political and social things and taking place in the country is pretty negative. And the one thing that beyond all of this that has really been kind of pushed to the back burner that I would like reporters to follow up with is that his wife was very critical in a lot of ways in terms of what he said, because she felt like she would be willing to work with LeBron James and work with these children, and what he was doing was very, very, very positive. And that comment came out, but there hasn't been a whole lot of follow-up with her. And I think that you know, what she said was extremely, extremely profound. So it's very sad that the President of the United States is showing some of the maybe poorest leadership that we've seen come out of this office since the country was established.
Yeah, and going back to some of the economics of sports and the relationship between the owners and the players. So the Royals used to be really good, and this year they're really terrible, and the Orioles are sort of in the same boat, the Baltimore Orioles. But they tried to trade Adam Jones, one of their best players, to the Phillies, who are a better team this year, probably going to make the playoffs. But Adam Jones used his 10-5 rights to nix the trade, and he actually wanted to stay with the Orioles, which from a labor perspective, we have to see that as a good thing, right? I mean, just as far as the state of how the players are being compensated and free agency sort of across the board, how do you feel that's going now? Are we going to have some more labor conflicts coming up in the major professional sports soon? And do you think the players are getting a reasonable shake right now?
Not sure about that. There's a possibility, because I understand where you're coming from, that, you know, Adam Jones could have gone to a team that was contending, the Phillies, and helped them. But as a player, been in the league, you know, 10 years and five, has the ability to nix any kind of trade. On the other side, we have some holdouts that are taking place right now, one in Los Angeles with the lineman Donald, and the other one, of course, out in Oakland, and Oakland slash Las Vegas with Khalil Mack. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, Major League Baseball, there's an argument that can be made that maybe they have one of the strongest unions of the three major professional sports in this country. When you look at the guaranteed amount of money that they have, and they also have free agency that is unrestricted free agency. And the NFL has free agency, but in a lot of ways it's really restricted free agency, in that the steps that you have to go to become an unrestricted free agent, the number of years that you have to almost put yourself in the circumstances make it extremely difficult for superstars to become unrestricted free agents. So Khalil Mack and Donald have outplayed their rookie deals after 4 years. The team has a right then to to re-up one more year, a fifth-year option. And a fifth-year option, it does not pay them anywhere near the type of money that's a top player at their position, particularly Miller out of Denver. So, you know, they don't want to play under a fifth-year option. But why should a team, and again, the NFL Players Association signed off on this deal, why should a player after 4 years give a team another opportunity to control them for a fifth year? After 4 years, both sides should be able to decide whether or not either the player has shown athletic ability and ability to play at a high level, or the player feels like the team is not going to pay him what he feels like he should be paid. He should be able to be an unrestricted free agent maybe and go out there and have an opportunity to solicit offers from other teams. And even within that, if they pick the fifth-year option, then in the NFL they have an opportunity to then turn around and franchise you like the Pittsburgh Steelers have done. With their outstanding running back and what the Washington Redskins did with their quarterback over the last couple of seasons. And so, you know, it's very, very difficult for NFL players to, in my opinion, have the same kind of autonomy economically that players have in baseball, because it's very, very, very difficult to maneuver to a point where you become really an unrestricted free agent. And even though they have a version of unrestricted free agencies, in a lot of ways it's very similar to what baseball had prior to unrestricted free agency, which is its reserve clause. Once a player is drafted by an NFL team, there's so many steps between the fifth-year option and the ability to franchise players that it makes it very difficult, in my opinion, for players to actually go out if a team plays hardball and solicit offers, which now increases your chances, of course, and increases the amount of money that you can now generate for yourself in a contract.
One player, you know, I mentioned at the beginning who still doesn't have a contract, and if you look at the sports press right now, you know, it's kind of slow, but a lot of articles have been coming out about how this is a really weak crop of backup quarterbacks. Everyone's hoping that their team's main quarterback for the year doesn't get injured, because there's not really anyone out there to go out and get, except, of course, maybe Colin Kaepernick, whose collusion case is still ongoing. There was a fracas recently because of they bleeped his name out of the video game. So how do you think his collusion case is going now? How much longer do you think we'll have to wait, and what impact might it have?
Well, this is one of the most disappointing aspects of this whole protest scenario, is that this young man in 2016 took a knee throughout the season. He didn't play last year. He's probably not going to be able to play this year. And as you alluded to, clearly he has the requisite skill set to be at the minimum a backup quarterback for one of the 32 NFL teams that are going to play football this upcoming season. There's a strong argument when you look around the league that maybe half the teams could use him as a starting quarterback. This is a player that took the San Francisco 49ers to the Super Bowl, where they lost a very, very, very close game to the Baltimore Ravens. So it's clearly a level of collusion that's taking place. He's being used as an example that if you buck the system and you show that you have any kind of real individual kind of thought, and you decide that you're going to take on these social, economic, maybe political issues as relate to race in this country and police brutality, and you bring all this attention to yourself by taking basically just a knee. We're not talking about anybody putting their hands on a person or driving a car under the influence or doing something even on the field that crosses the line. He's simply just kneeling. That you will now pay a price that, in essence, equates to you're going to lose your future in terms of your career. Because this is the most egregious aspect of this whole thing, is that Colin Kaepernick is not having an opportunity to earn a living playing football and maybe helping some team. And there clearly was individual teams that talked about, looked at him, but there seemed to be a informal process by the other owner, NFL owner, said, look, don't do it. We want to make an example, and we want to send a clear message that he is not going to be given an opportunity to play. So it's a very, very, very frustrating thing because, you know, in this country, we preach about this idea of opportunity. You can be whatever you want to be when you come to the United States of America and democracy and so on and so forth. We're talking about a country that was born out of protest. And yet this young man is paying a heavy, heavy price for standing up to his own beliefs.
This is Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum. Today we had on Professor Charles Ross. He's the author of Mavericks, Money and Men, the AFL, Black Players, and the Evolution of Modern Football. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate it, and good luck to the Chiefs this upcoming season.
All right. Thanks. We might need it, so. All right.
Oh, no. No, no. Your quarterback may do some things people may be a little bit surprised that he's going to do on the field. So it should be a good season for him.
Yeah. Patrick, if you're listening, good luck. And
okay.
Bye, Dr. Ross.
Take care.
Jim Hightower is coming to Kansas City for a KKFI fundraiser. On Saturday, August 11th, All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, Hightower and KC music legend Danny Cox will be the featured guests at a meet-and-greet dinner, followed by a hell-raising speech by Jim Hightower at 7:30. Tickets are $60 for meet-and-greet plus hell-raising speech, $20 for speech only. Details and ticket information at kkfi.org/conference.
The Mid-America Regional Council Air Quality Program has issued an orange ozone alert today, which indicates high levels of ozone pollution in our air. Individuals with asthma or other breathing problems, heart conditions, and all young children and seniors should limit their outdoor activity. Please avoid unnecessary driving today and postpone mowing your lawn and refueling your vehicle to help reduce pollution. For more information, visit marc.org/airq.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Water is one of the greatest disruptors in the world. Not because of water, but because of mankind. But water is also the biggest opportunity.
Dutch water wizard and designer Henk Ovink tells us how we can climate-proof our cities and coasts. This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines. Women of faith cry out for immigrant children. On Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White, and today we're going to be discussing housing in the United States in general, in Kansas City, why housing is so unequal right now, what are the drivers, is it policy, is it just the market, what's going on here? And we have a special guest who knows a lot about housing and a lot about development, whether in Kansas City or beyond, and that's Phil Glynn. Phil, thanks for joining us today. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background?
Sure. Thanks for having me. Really excited about the invitation. Big fan of 90.1 and KKFI, and you know, affordable housing is my passion, so I love talking about this stuff all the time. I look at this from the point of view of being a business owner. I'm president of a company called Travoy. Travoy works across the country to build affordable housing and to catalyze community development in economically distressed communities. So we've been around since 1995, and we've helped develop over 5,000 new or rehabilitated housing units that are affordable to low-income families. We've financed a total of $1.3 billion worth of housing and community development across America during that time.
Like a lot of issues that this country is facing right now, it seems people point fingers at each other about what's going on here. So lately, there's been a lot of pressure growing on Ben Carson, who's the HUD secretary, to step up his game. But he replies in turn and says, you know, this is really mostly a local issue. Can you take us into the weeds a little bit on that and what you think about Ben Carson's performance so far as a business owner who's involved and works with HUD?
Sure. The first thing I'll say, and I'll say this both as a business owner, as a citizen, but also as somebody who's running for mayor of Kansas City, every issue is a local issue. You know, our local communities is where, that's where our lives happen. So there are lots of parts of the economy and parts of the government where federal action is required, but where we live with the consequences of those actions is in our local communities. So obviously, housing is a local issue, but the reason we have a federal Department of Housing and Urban Development is that the local housing markets where we all live are heavily influenced by national and international financial markets. That's why we have, that's why HUD exists, is to help increase the stock of and maintain the quality of America's affordable housing. We're facing an affordable housing crisis in pretty much every major community in the United States. And for a federal agency head to be this passive about it is very disturbing. So in my capacity as a business owner at Travoy, we interact with U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development all the time. And we deal with great career professionals there, but we really feel like the political leadership at HUD is asleep at the switch because we're seeing a lack of affordable housing affecting the stability of families in the communities where we work at Travoy, which are American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian communities. We refer to the communities where we work, generally speaking, as Indian country. I mean, throughout Indian country, affordable housing has been a problem for a very long time. The lack of access to quality affordable housing is driven where our communities, the communities we serve as a business, primarily by the fact that construction costs are extremely high in really remote rural areas. So they face an affordability issue that's different from what we face in the city. The reason that it's difficult to build affordable housing in the communities where we work are, for example, we work with communities in, you know, rural Alaskan Native communities. These are communities sometimes of fewer than 100 people, where it costs $8 million to build a small 10-bed assisted living facility that would, the construction cost of something like that in Kansas City or the suburbs of Kansas City would be half of that or maybe even a third of that. Because you have, when you're building on permafrost and, you know, in the Arctic, you need to ship construction materials you're using and sometimes even construction labor from faraway cities like Anchorage or even Seattle. So it's the remoteness of those communities that drives up the cost of housing in the communities where we work, generally speaking. What's driving up the cost of housing in lower 48 communities and what we're seeing in Kansas City is supply and demand. So when we kicked off this conversation, you were saying, you know, is this something that's the result of policy forces or market forces? It's both. But the reason we have these policy tools is to respond to market forces. Kansas City is growing. We are seeing new people move into our community, and that is a good thing. But supply and demand dictates that as demand goes up, the price of that product is going to go up too. And we are seeing, and because we aren't doing enough as a community to bring new quality, affordable units onto the market, that's one of the reasons that we're seeing prices go up. Kansas City is responding to this affordable housing crisis that we're experiencing right now by doing things like subsidizing luxury housing, like the Three Light Project downtown. It's absolutely the wrong response. What we need to be doing is building units that are affordable to the lowest income families in our communities, because people at the lowest end of the income strata, and this is something that we see in our work in Native American communities also, they're the most vulnerable to some kind of economic shock, like economic shock, an injury at work, an illness in the family, the loss of a job, the cutback in hours maybe that takes place where they work. It doesn't take very much for a family that's already has their month-to-month budget so strained by the fact their income is so low. When they experience any kind of financial hardship, that's when you see they have to move. That's when you see evictions, and that's when you see people having to move. And those families are having to move so much that when you think about the impact that has on the children in those families, what does that mean? Well, that means they're switching schools multiple times in 1 year. That's making it impossible to learn. It's making it impossible for that kid to develop relationships with the people in his or her class. It's making it impossible for that kid's teacher to really build a relationship with them and make that school year a successful learning experience. It's hard on the parents and grandparents because, you know, part of life is getting to know your neighbors, and part of living in a safe, healthy community is knowing the people who live around you so that you can reach out if you have an issue. And when people are forced to move so often, we end up in a situation where families in our community are not stable. And if we could stabilize families in Kansas City, a lot of the other economic and crime and community issues that we face would be a lot easier to deal with. Because ultimately, You know, like we were talking about with HUD a second ago, is it something that's happening at the federal level or at the local level? My belief about business and my belief about economics and politics is that the solutions to all these problems always start at the local level. The people who are living in a community where an issue is taking place, they're the best equipped and the best informed to deal with that issue. But if we don't have a stable housing situation in Kansas City where people can afford to put down roots and develop relationships with their neighbors, those neighborhoods aren't going to be well equipped to deal with the things that are taking place on their streets. I mean, we're facing a crisis of violence in Kansas City right now. I may be wrong about these exact numbers, but I think as of today, we've seen 28 shootings in the last week. And ultimately, the response to that kind of crime and that level of violence in Kansas City, it's going to take everybody. It's going to take pastors. It's going to take neighborhood leaders. Obviously, it's going to take police and law enforcement and city government. But ultimately, the people who make a neighborhood safer are the people who live in that neighborhood. They establish social norms. They know each other. They have relationships with each other. So this isn't just about building units. This isn't just about rooftops. The development of affordable housing is also about giving community leaders the support that they need and the tools they need to address violence and to create really healthy, tight-knit communities. Because people who live in the communities, again, are always going to be the best ones to lead that charge.
I wonder how much of this is like really just a conflict, just completely different interests. I remember reading about Three Light, and I think someone from the EDC said that, you know, like if we want to be Minneapolis or Dallas or Denver, that we need to build Three Light. And, you know, is their idea of what a good downtown is just like a lot of expensive restaurants that most people can't live in? You know, like how much of this is just like a political battle about how our city should look?
I think that a lot of people in politics do not come from a business background. And I think that the measuring stick for success that we have in our political culture in Kansas City is ribbon cuttings, ceremonial hard hats, golden shovels. How many projects can I say I was a part of getting out of the ground at whatever cost? And I just disagree with that. I don't think that you measure economic success in a community just by groundbreakings. That's important. We need more affordable housing in Kansas City. We need more affordable housing production. And there are tools that already exist that we could be using differently and using better to build a lot of new housing units. But the way that I measure success is in terms of other numbers, real quality of life indicators. Where are wages? Where are rents and mortgage payments that are affordable to people, meaning where people are paying less than 30% of their income to keep a roof over their head and their family's heads? And what are the disparities in life expectancy and health between neighborhoods also? So if we started measuring our economic success based on the quality of life of our people and not, like you said, some arbitrary standard of just having this skyscraper measuring contest between cities, then we would start moving in the right direction. But we do need to build new units. That's the thing. You know, I'm not saying that we don't. More production is part of how we will bring rents down to a level that's manageable for families in Kansas City. We need to understand that, especially when we're building in our central city and historic neighborhoods that have been around a long time, we've got long-term residents who are very invested in their neighborhood and very involved and have some influence at City Hall. We need to make sure that, you know, neighborhoods should be able to have a vision and influence the development that happens around them, but we can't have just this not in my backyard, NIMBY attitude. You know, we need to move toward we need to have a yes in my backyard attitude, and we need to have a city of YIMBYs. And I think that we have a lot of people who do feel that way. And if we could undergo a change in thinking in Kansas City about density and how it's healthy within reason for neighborhoods, how it puts more people on the sidewalks, which puts more eyes on the street, which puts more lighting on the street, all are things that may make it a little tougher to park in Kansas City, but I think they're going to make it a lot easier to walk to school, to raise a family, to have a high quality of life.
Do you think that we'll talk about like some really specific power and light area stuff, and then we'll talk about the national a little more. We have about like 5-10 more minutes. But do you think that the buildings that have gone up recently, I guess I'm thinking mostly of One Light, like do you think that they even really help density? Because I think there's like a dog park that's just like on the second floor, like so that you don't even have to go downstairs, like you don't have to be on the sidewalk at all. So do you think that building more affordable housing will help add more density? Do you think that people that live in One Light are even going down on the street very much?
I think some are, but I think there's also a problem of, you know, if you can pull into an underground parking garage, hop on an elevator, and get back into your apartment, then, you know, you're really only experiencing the city through your windshield and through the windows of your apartment. Right. We should be building our city in a way where people can experience the diversity of Kansas City and the walkability of Kansas City. And experiencing the sights and sounds and smells of city life is something I've always loved about Kansas City. We have this beautiful city of trees. We have a diverse city. We have great restaurants. And the experience of those things is enriched by being out in the world. You know what I mean? Being out on the sidewalk, being on your bike, like you took to get here, right? You see the city in a totally different way when you get out of your car and you get out of your house. So there are ways to build more affordable housing and to do it in a way that increases density, where if we think a little more creatively, it's not a choice between a single family house on a half acre lot or a giant apartment tower in downtown Kansas City. There's all kinds of other options on the spectrum between those two things. And there are things that we can do to increase density, even in neighborhoods where the neighbors don't want multifamily development. Accessory dwelling units are an option. It would take some changes in how we regulate real estate development in Kansas City, and it would be complicated, but I think we could figure it out. When you think about all the carriage houses and large garages and secondary properties that are part of single family homes in Kansas City, that creates a lot of opportunity to add affordable rental dwellings of some kind. And I'm not talking about short-term rentals like Airbnb. I'm talking about a home for somebody. But that could be an opportunity for a homeowner to invest in a part of their property that they're not using every day, to earn some more income, increase their own economic stability, and also put another affordable housing unit on the market without having to go through the endless, you know, approval process required to build a big giant building. And that puts one more person out on the sidewalk every day. It brings one more person into our communities where we need more economic activity. It's going to create more neighbors, and the more neighbors we have, the stronger neighborhoods we're going to have.
You're mentioning Airbnb actually reminded me for a show that I did a couple weeks ago. I went to a Landlords Inc. meeting where they were talking about, how they were going to get people to vote against the new inspection policy, which passed. And if you want to talk a little bit about the elections this week too, that's great. But one of the things that they said was like, oh, we're just going to turn a bunch of our apartment stock into Airbnbs, and then we won't have to deal with these city regulations. Do you think that that's a really empty threat? And what are your thoughts about the elections this week?
We are going to, if I am mayor, live up to the letter and the spirit of the law that we just passed as a community. The Healthy Homes Initiative is going to be how we do business in Kansas City. It's going to be how we ensure that every child in this community, regardless of where they're living, grows up in a healthy environment. It's not going to solve. It's not a perfect solution, and there may be people that try to game that system, but I'm going to be a mayor who goes to work every day very focused on making sure that we implement the clear will of the people on that issue. So I thought that, you know, yes on question one winning yesterday was a very exciting thing. I voted for it, and I stood out and got sunburned working at the polls in my neighborhood all day long with a guy named Jerry McAvoy, who was a real advocate for it and knew a lot about the issue and learned a lot about affordable housing by talking with him. I mean, this is what I do every day, and I'm still constantly learning new things, which is one of the great things about running for mayor is, you know, you have the freedom to, and you have the platform to ask a lot of questions and meet all kinds of interesting, diverse people and talk about, you know, all these other issues that are super important to Kansas City.
Cool. What about the other election? I think it was vote no on question A. Was that?
I voted no on Prop A.
Yeah.
I'm in awe of what organized labor accomplished in this election cycle. I mean, to go from rock bottom of the right wing elements in Missouri finally getting the right to work for less law that they had wanted for generations. They got it. They declared victory. They spiked the football. And I think it would have been very, very easy for organized labor to just say, hey, they have a supermajority, there's nothing we can do about it. And they decided to invest so much of their political capital and so much of their financial capital in a very, very long, difficult campaign. And that was a huge win. And they did it the old-fashioned way. That was yard signs. That was neighbors talking to neighbors. That was people explaining very clearly to voters why the right to work law that was passed was bad for Missouri. And the voters clearly agreed. They voted overwhelmingly. And like it was kind of like you and I were, when we were chatting before this started about some travels we've had recently, there weren't just vote no on Prop A signs in, you know, in the sort of Brookside, Waldo corridor in Kansas City, Missouri. I mean, I took my family camping down to the Lake of the Ozarks last weekend, and we saw vote no on Prop A signs in all the rural areas that we drove through also. So I was not surprised that it passed. I was very pleasantly surprised by how much it passed. And I think that is just a huge credit to, you know, Jessica Padola with the painters and all the other people involved in organized labor, all the people who've been working down at that office in Midtown, everyone who's gone out and knocked on doors and canvassed for that. it was a team effort, and we got it done.
Another really big issue for the labor movement right now that's associated with the housing issue. I meant to bring up this stat at the beginning, but it was from a recent Washington Post article that said that median rents have rose by 32% in real dollars from 2001 to 2015, while in real dollars wages have remained pretty flat. And I know in the past you've been pretty vocal about living wage and raising the wage. And if you want to talk a little bit about how you feel about that now and how that plays into your mayoral campaign.
Sure. I think that when it comes to affordable housing, we need to have an inclusionary zoning ordinance in Kansas City. We can create a local housing trust fund with the in lieu of payments that are made as part of that. We can ensure that new units coming onto the market are affordable. We can rethink our zoning laws and reimagine the way that we approve development to bring more accessory dwelling units into our communities. We can use Chapter 353 overlays and other kinds of tools to control the property taxes of long-term residents in these neighborhoods to make sure that we don't have gentrification driving out long-term residents. We have all these different tools in the toolbox to address the specifics of affordable housing. But like you just said, there's no point in building more affordable housing for people who can't even afford to live in those units. So yes, as a business owner, I have been very vocal about increasing the minimum wage in Kansas City. I think it's wrong for people to work full-time, to take care of business, do what they're supposed to do, and to not be able to meet the basic expenses of life in a Midwestern community. I believe that that's wrong. I believe that we tell people from the time they're young that if you work, you will be able to have a basic standard of living in this society, and we've gotten to a point where that's not the case. And those of us who do pay our employees living wages are basically, through paying taxes, subsidizing the bad practices of some huge employers that do not pay living wages. There is a cost to society to keeping a roof over people's heads, to ensuring that children can eat and that families can meet the basic expenses of life. We've already made that decision as a society. Now the decision we're talking about is, how do we share that burden? I think the way that burden should be shared is that the business owners who are, you know, benefiting and reaping the economic rewards of the work that the people who work for their companies do, and I see it every day, we have an amazing team of people at Travoy, and our company is successful because of those people, all right? That's good for me as the owner of the business. That's good for everyone who works at our company. It's good for our investors. It's our team effort together that creates those economic benefits. And we need to make sure that we're reinvesting in our people. And one of the ways that we do that is by paying a living wage. So Travoy is, I think, the most prominent for-profit business that has come out in favor of a living wage. I was really proud and excited to be recognized by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with their President's Award because of that last year. Dr. Vernon Howard is a good friend of mine and somebody whose voice I really, really respect on issues of workers' rights and issues of social justice. We just believe that it's good for business. You know, we think to be a successful business, you have to be part of a successful, healthy community. And it's better for our local economy if workers have more money in their pockets, more money to spend. So getting back to affordable housing, I'm an affordable housing professional. That's what I do. And I think that's something unique that I bring to the race for mayor, is that I'm not just thinking about these things theoretically. I'm not interested in having a debate about how we get this done. I'm interested in using my direct career experience of building hundreds of millions of dollars of affordable housing coast to coast to this community, and doing it through the community-based approach that has made our company successful doing this kind of work nationally. I'm focused on creating more affordable housing units. But we also have to think about just all the other costs associated with living in Kansas City. We're not bringing in enough jobs that pay a living wage and allow for a schedule that allows for families to be together and for people to spend time with their kids after work. We need to be focused on that. We should only be using our economic incentive programs to support or retain or bring in jobs that are family wage jobs, living wage jobs. The other thing we need to think about is the fact that the constant increases that too many people in our community are seeing on their water bills is also affecting the cost of people's living. You know, whether it's rent or water or any of the other expenses you have to pay, at the end of the month, you've got to make those numbers add up somehow. So we also need to wrap all of these monthly economic issues, I think, into one conversation. We don't have job quality over here on one side of the debate and affordable housing over there on the other side of the debate and water rate increases in some other sphere of political life. We need to have a strategy where we're investing in our people by ensuring that people can have a good quality of life in Kansas City. And there are lots of different facets to that. So as a business owner, that gives me a unique perspective on these things, because I don't start by viewing them from a political lens. I view these things through an economic lens. And right now in Kansas City, I believe there's a connection between the violence that we're seeing in our streets, and the economic violence of an economy that doesn't provide the quality of jobs people need to live and affordable housing in safe and healthy communities. I believe it's possible to have all of those things and to have a successful business community. I would go a step further and say we don't have a successful business community until we have those things. Again, because there's no point. You can't be a successful business in a failing community. Those two things, it just can't happen. It's not possible.
Some of the landlords in Kansas City might disagree with that, but they lost yesterday, so who cares what they have to think. We've been talking to Phil Glynn. He is running for mayor in Kansas City. He's a business owner from the Crossroads, longtime Kansas City resident. It's been really nice having you in the studio here at KKFI. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. On Tuesday, Missouri made history by becoming the first state to ever repeal right to work through a referendum. This campaign was a year in the making, and it involved thousands of people. The No on Prop A campaign kicked off on February 3, 2017, when our recently deseated Governor Greitens signed into law SB 19, Right to Work. On that very day, the Missouri AFL-CIO filed language to begin circulating a referendum petition to repeal the new law. This campaign was locally directed by Jessica Padola of Painters Local 3, along with so many others. Some of the key Kansas City organizers were Zach Sweets, Katie Graham, Josh Rich, Aaron Shrimp, Nilda Garcia-Cortez, T. Freeman, Karina Lopez, and Kay Thompson, who organized day-to-day political actions. We Are Missouri and the Labor Coalition had thousands of hours of volunteered to knock doors and make phone calls. There were also faith-based groups, community groups, labor members, and labor allies from across the state and beyond intimately involved with this fight. The Missouri AFL-CIO assembled an amazingly talented team made up of machinists, painters, electricians, sheet metal workers, steel workers, and service employees and food workers. If not for the leadership of the statewide political director, Mary Berry, and her hand-picked team of relief staff, we may not have won by such a wide margin. In late March of 2017, training began for union members to become notaries public, as well as training on how to properly circulate petitions. Members then took petitions to their communities, their churches, sporting events, everything they could think of that had large numbers of people who might be reached. Members talked with other Missouri residents one-on-one and were able to answer their questions about the new right-to-work law and about why it was so vital to repeal it as soon as possible. On August 10, 2017, we turned in 310,567 signatures, including voters from every district, to the Missouri Secretary of State's office. He later admitted that we'd actually miscounted by one signature, his total coming out to 310,568. I sang "This Land Is Your Land" in the Capitol building that day, and as we turned in the signatures, such an honor and a memory I will cherish for the rest of my life. After such a Herculean effort, we took the holiday season off to secure in the knowledge that we had won for Missouri citizens the right to vote on whether or not they wanted their state to become right to work. In February of 2018, it became apparent that some legislators in Jeff City intended to move the Prop A vote to the August ballot, and the campaign fired up again. With that August 7th vote date would come a July 11th deadline for voter registration. And so dozens and more members went back into their communities and began registering voters, as well as distributing Vote No pledge cards. In order to succeed, the campaign needed to pick up around 500,000 votes from the general public, folks who were not affiliated with labor. Members phone banked and went door to door speaking to their fellow citizens, pushing through our American taboo of discussing politics and engaging in dialogue about the truth about right to work and how it stood to devastate our state as well as the greater region. Members also asked people to sign pledge cards promising to vote no on Prop A. All that hard work paid off on August 7, 2018, when we received 937,241 no votes, which was 67% of the voters. We saved our state from the devastation of right to work. Unionists in Missouri proved that they are capable of leading the movement and winning, something we could use a lot more of in 2018. In the course of this fight, we networked with members of other unions who were already our neighbors, but we otherwise may never have met. We made friends, we made allies, we made solidarity. We also got to spend time with union members from across the country who shared our passion for defeating this law. Together, we demonstrated the awesome power that organized labor is still capable of wielding in this dystopian age of attacks on workers. I hope this current momentum carries over into November and beyond, maybe even into some picket lines. Special thanks to this story to Brian Simmons of Machinist Local 778. Have a good evening, everyone.
And that was Ariana Eckel with Remember Our Struggle, and we will remember this struggle for a long time. Now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Starting tomorrow night, Friday evening, and continuing all day Saturday, Kicking the Coke Habit and Expanding Democracy for All, a conference sponsored by KKFI and a bunch of other organizations. If you still want to register, it's getting pretty full, but you can still do it. Go to kkfi.org/conference. The kickoff for the Safe and Welcoming Wyandotte County campaign is Wednesday, August 15th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Support a city that welcomes immigrants and provides municipal ideas for its poor and for its immigrants. America Needs Unions, March and Rally, Thursday, August 16th, 5 p.m., Oppenstein Brothers Park, 1123 Walnut Street, Kansas City, Missouri. And Women's Equality Week starts August 19th and continues through the 26th. Go to Women's Equality Week on Facebook for the schedule. There are many programs. Finally, the Labor Day Parade will happen Monday, September 3rd. Stay tuned. That's it for the Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. Our show is called Trump's Federal Remix, a new Department of Child Labor, and privatize the Postal Service? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zeman.
Disgrace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Where you come from to struggle.